This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest today is writer Grace Paley. She's considered one of the masters of the short story form. Paley describes herself as a slightly combative pacifist. She's been active in the peace and feminist movements for many years, as are some of her characters. Paley grew up in a working-class Jewish neighborhood in the Bronx and has spent most of her adult life in Greenwich Village. She says that years of overhearing neighbors gossiping in the street developed her ear for the speaking styles of different ethnic groups. In her stories, Paley has always been interested in women's lives, their friendships with each other, and the kinds of love they have for their children, lovers, and spouses. Grace Paley has written three short story collections in the last 25 years, The Little Disturbances of Man, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, and her latest, Later the Same Day. Before we talked about her life, I asked Grace Paley to read a story from her new book, Later the Same Day.
The name of the story is Love. And first I wrote this poem. Walking up the slate path of the college park under the nearly full moon, the brown oak leaves are red as maples. And I have been looking at the young people. They speak and embrace one another. Because of them, I thought I would descend into remembering love. So I let myself down hand over hand until my feet touched the earth of the gardens of Vesey Street. I told my husband, I've just written a poem about love. What a good idea, he said. Then he told me about Sally Johnson on Lake Winnipesaukee, who was 12 and a half when he was 14. Then he told me about Rosemary Johansson on Lake Sunapee. Then he told me about Jane Marston in Concord High. Then he told me about Mary Smythe of Radcliffe when he was a poet at Harvard. Then he told me about two famous poets, one fair and one dark, both now dead, when he was a secret poet working at an acceptable trade in an office without windows. When at last he came to my time, that is, the past 15 years or so, he told me about Dottie Wasserman. Hold on, I said. What do you mean, Dottie Wasserman? She's a character in a book. She's not even a person. Okay, he said. Then why Vesey Street? What's that? Well, it's nothing special. I used to be in love with a guy who was a shrub buyer. Vesey Street was the downtown garden center of the city, when the city still had wonderful centers of commerce. I used to walk the kids there when they were little carriage babies, half asleep. Maybe take the ferry to Hoboken. Years later, I'd bike down there on Sundays, ride around and around. I even saw him three times. No kidding, said my husband. How come I don't know the guy? Ugh, the stupidity of the beloved. It's you, I said. Anyway, what's this baloney about you and Dottie Wasserman? Nothing much. She was this crazy kid who hung around the bars. But she didn't drink. Really, it was for the men, you know. Neither did I drink too much. I was just hoping to get laid once in a while, or maybe meet someone and fall madly in love. He is that romantic. Sometimes I wonder if loving me in this homey life in middle age with two sets of bedroom slippers, one a skin of sandal for summer, and the other pair lined with cozy sheepskin, it must be a disappointing experience for him. He made a polite bridge over my conjectures. He said, she was also this funny mother in the park years later when we were all doing the municipal politics and I was married to Josephine. Dottie and I were both delegates to that famous Kansas City National Meeting of Town Meetings. NMTM, remember? Some woman. No, I said, that's not true. She was made up, just plain invented in the late 50s. Oh, he said, then it was after that. I must have met her afterwards. He is stubborn, so I dropped the subject and went to get the groceries. Our shrinking family requires more coffee, more eggs, more cheese, less butter, less meat, less orange juice, more grapefruit. Walking along the street, encountering no neighbor, I hummed a little up-and-down tune and continued jostling time with the help of my nice reconnoitering brain. Here I was, experiencing the old earth of Vesey Street, breathing in and out with more attention to the process than is usual in the late morning. All because of love, probably. How interesting the way it glides to solid, invented figures from true remembered wraiths. By God, I thought, the lover is real. The heart of the lover continues. It has been propagandized from birth. I passed our local bookstore, which was doing well with the joy of all sex underpinning its prosperity. The owner gave me, a dependable customer of poorly advertised books, an affectionate smile. He was a great success. He didn't know that 3 years later, his rent would be tripled, he would become a sad failure, and the landlord, feeling himself brilliant, an outwitting entrepreneur, a star in the microeconomic heavens, he would be the famous success. From half a block away, I could see the kale in the grocer's bin, crumbles of ice shining the dark leaves. In interior counter view, I imagined my husband's North Country fields, the late autumn frost, and the curly green. I began to mumble a new poem. In the grocer's bin, the green kale shines. In the North Country, it stands sweet with frost, dark and curly, in a garden of tan hay and light white snow. Light white? I said that a couple of questioning times. Suddenly, my outside eyes saw a fine-looking woman named Margaret, who hadn't spoken to me in 2 years. We'd had many years of political agreement before some matters relating to the Soviet Union separated us. In the angry months during which we were both right in many ways, she took away with her, to her political position and daily friendship, my own best friend Louise, my lifelong Park, PTA, and anti-war movement sister, Louise. In a hazy litter of love and leafy green vegetables, I saw Margaret's good face, and before I remembered our serious difference, I smiled. At the same moment, she knew me and smiled. So foolish is the true lover when responded to, that I took her hand as we passed, bent to it, pressed it to my cheek, and touched it with my lips. I described all this to my husband at supper time. "Well, of course," he said, "don't you know?" The smile was for Margaret, but really, you do miss Louise a lot, and the kiss was for Louise. We both said, "Ah." Then we talked over the way the salt treaty looked more like a floor than a ceiling, read a poem written by one of his daughters, looked at a TV show telling the destruction of the European textile industry, and then made love. In the morning, he said, "You're some lover, you know." He said, "You really are. You remind me a lot of Dottie Wasserman."
Love that story. The story is called Love, and it's from Grace Paley's new collection of stories called Later the Same Day, which is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. The voices that you write with for the narrator and for the characters, I think are really like vernacular voices, and they're always so perfect. Everybody doesn't speak the same. Everybody has their own really distinctive way of speaking. It's very, for some of them, it's very ethnic. For others, it's very urban. Do you think that relates to where you grew up and what your upbringing was like?
Well, I think language really comes written language. It's the language of the story or of the whatever it is, of the poem, or really the language that you use when it works comes from probably a couple of places, and one of them is literature itself. You know, what you've been reading and thinking about, and I mean by literature, I even mean Mother Goose rhymes. You know, I mean really songs, traditional verses, and books. You know, whatever you read growing up. But the other, I always think of it as two ears, you know. So with one ear you hear that, but with your other ear, which is probably more important, you really hear the sounds of your own time, and your own place, and the ordinary sounds of it, the speech of your own neighborhood, of your own household, of your friends, your street, your region, your community, you know, and that's in your ear, you know, that comes in your ear starting at about zero.
Well, you grew up in the Bronx,
yes,
in the 1920s. Can you describe what your neighborhood was like?
Well, every week somebody's furniture was on the street. I mean, that's my first memories of my block, is that all of this, people were evicted, well, every day. And you'd see this pile of furniture out there covered with newspapers and covered with tarpaulin. And that, it was mostly it was practically entirely Jewish. And people there came from Eastern Europe, Poland, and Russia, mostly. And in our house, the languages that were spoken were Russian, Yiddish, and English.
Did you speak
all
of those?
And they were spoken in equal parts. Well, I never spoke either Yiddish or Russian well, but I always understood it very well and spoke it to my grandmother, because she never got English.
Were there real talkers in your family or in the neighborhood who you would listen to and whose speech you think really affects you now in your writing?
Well, my father was a great talker. My mother was very quiet, and I think probably because my father was such a great talker. But he really was a good storyteller and very smart and very funny. And my mother was very serious and quite different, but very straightforward and very honorable person. And in the neighborhood, the people talked all the time. And people sat outside in the street, you know. The street life was very exciting, and you couldn't get me some summer nights. Since I was the youngest by a lot, I was also overprotected and also neglected at the same time. I'd have to wear long stockings, you know, into the end of April. But on the other hand, they'd kind of forget that I was still outside at 11 o'clock at night on a summer night. So I had that kind of happy mixture. But the street was full of people, and it was a great. I think all writers are people who get in the habit, who love to listen, who listen a lot. So that one of the stories in this book is called The Story Hearer, and it's really what every storyteller has to be.
Were there stories that would get told to you over and over again, or was it not that kind of storytelling? Was it just like more like gossip in the street that people would talk about?
Well, first of all, I have a lot of regard for gossip. I regard it as the last great oral tradition, and the reason it's called gossip is that women do it, so that therefore it's kind of denigrated for that reason. those were stories to me, you know, that people told about their life. What happened to you yesterday? You know, that kind of story. What happened? Oh, you know. So he came home then, did he? Yeah, you know, and all of that kind of thing. And then the stories of my family at home were always telling what had happened first in Europe and then here, and there was a lot to hear and a lot to listen to. And you listen because you think, oh, this is going to be my life. This is my life. I'm hearing my future. I'm hearing what I'm about. And I listened a great deal to the, as I said, because of the street and the kind of neighborhood it was, I really, really lived out there, really among people who were in a very different economic life than I was. And that became very important to me.
When you started writing, did you go through a period of wanting to get the neighborhood out of your voice?
Oh, no. See, once when I wrote stories, I was what I was, you know, and I never felt like wanting to get to change my language in my own speech. I remember when we were going to school, and there was something that I used to call Hunter College English, and I swore to God I'd never talk like that, if no matter what happened, you know. It seemed like a theft of my language, of my New Yorkese, and it. It bothered me, and there was a lot of the older people, a little bit older than I, were in my sister and brothers, among my sister and brothers' friends, really had begun to talk like that. And also, I don't think people realize this, but during the Depression or after the Depression, the only jobs people began to go into were teaching. Women could go into teaching. Well, the exams they gave in New York for teachers, and that included my sister and many of her friends and my sister-in-law, the exams they gave were very strict orals. So those orals were really designed at that time, although it seems now that 3/4 of the teachers in the city of New York say are Jewish. It seems like that, whether it's true or not. At that time, those exams were designed to keep immigrants out. And so people were going around like crazy, these older brothers and sisters of mine, people now in their 70s, I guess, trying to talk American, you know, and taking classes in it. And that was what used to drive me mad. I mean, I would just say, oh, you're all talking Hunter College English. And I'd get very angry about it. On the other hand, when I began to write poetry, I wrote in a very literary way, and that's what was wrong with it. I read a lot of poetry, and I didn't use, I said there were two ears. There was this ear that listens, you know, for the tradition of our own literature, and then there's the ear that, and you've got to use both ears, and then there's the neighborhood ear, so when I began to write poetry, I really was using my literary tradition ear. My speech never changed for some reason, but I was really, we were talking earlier about this, I remember taking this course with Auden and showing him my poems, and they were all written as though I went to Oxford or Cambridge or something. I used Britishisms throughout, you know. So there I was being very literary, and that's why they never got any good. They stayed pretty crummy for a long, long time, the poems.
What kind of advice did Auden give you?
Well, I was about 17, you know, he was very nice to me. He just said, do they use words like subaltern in English?
Wait, were you offended?
It was during the war. I said, sometimes, once in a while.
You didn't start writing short stories until you were in your 30s. Why weren't you writing short stories before? It just seems such the natural form for you.
Well, I thought my natural form was poetry. It's easy to say that now, but I thought of myself as a poet, or I never thought of myself as a poet. I always thought of myself as a poem writer, but in my 30s, and even though I was really writing better and had at least gotten my Britishisms out of me, I gotten a few other things in, but I got that out, thank God. The poems couldn't serve me, I mean, for what I wanted to do and for what I was thinking about. And, of course, what I was really thinking about and what was pressuring me in my life, which is where things come from, really, is something about women and men and how we lived, how we were not living together well on this earth, and how, and also, by then I'd had a couple kids, and I'd gotten much closer to women and thought a lot about women's lives and was very interested in them. And that's what I wanted to understand. I mean, you come to writing not from what you know, but from what you come to it with what you don't know, and that's what presses you to go on. And I couldn't do it in poems. Not that other people haven't, but I couldn't, for whatever reason.
Had your poems been about? What?
Kind of feelings a lot and so forth. I mean, a lot of stuff. I mean, some of them were very political. But whatever it is, I couldn't do this. I couldn't use character. I didn't know how. People are doing it now. They're doing it, you know, and did earlier also, but I didn't. For whatever reason, the humor or the character or whatever, the story form was right. And the short story is close to the poem. It's closer to the poem than it is to the novel, so.
Do you think so?
Yes, it is. It does what poems do in a lot of ways. It does it in prose. It gathers things together in a little knot or a big knot.
I'm speaking with Grace Paley, and I should mention she has a new collection of short stories called Later the Same Day, which has just been published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. So when your first book was published, was there a literary circle that you wanted to enter, or
no,
a life of a writer that you had in mind,
no,
that you wanted to start living?
I never wanted that, and I was scared of it. I never wanted to do that. Now, at this point in my life, I know a lot of writers, and I've been active in PEN and the writers' organizations, and worked with people, and I like them all. I like them. You know, I like a lot of them. Good friends. But I've never wanted to live in that life, and I'm surprised to the degree I'm in it now. But after my first book, I feared very much leaving my own everyday ordinary life on my street, with my kids, at the school, in the PTA, and as time went on, and other groups and other organizations that I worked with that had to do with the lives of people, and that's really what I never want to be taken away from.
That's funny, since so many people want their writing or artistic success to take them out of what they perceive to be a kind of a boring or mundane day-to-day life.
Yeah, but my life has never been boring or mundane, so that's okay. I mean, I liked a lot of, apart from my writing, I liked a lot of my life. I mean, I liked doing things around the school. I was just interested. It's not that it all seemed terribly interesting to me. I mean, I think that's really, I have a story there called An Interest in Life, and I really mean it when it's in some line there, I say that's all you need. And I think that's really, you know, it's not nice to quote yourself, but I think that's really what I feel always, that even as I go on now, and I'm 62, I feel that interest has really kept me going more than almost anything else. I was interested in the school. I was interested in the parks. I was interested in the municipal, in the workings of the municipality. I was interested in the politics of that. I was interested in the possibilities of doing something about social change in some way. It's called social. I don't know what we called it then. I guess now it's called social change. Anyway, and as time went on, I became more and more interested in international events, which I'd actually been interested in as a kid. You know, in high school even, I'd been.
In the 60s, you started being really active in the peace movement.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm saying that even when I was a kid in high school, I had these. They were just natural interests to me, which came from my family. That any citizen would be interested to know that there was the Spanish Civil War or Mussolini dropping bombs on Ethiopia. I mean, that seemed like any natural citizenly concern. And then they became more local for a while, and that also seems to me natural. I'm always surprised that it's not considered so.
What led to your political activism, like in the 1960s when you really started working in the peace movement? Was it just natural continuation?
Yeah, I think it was just a natural continuation. The kids were getting bigger, I guess before the Vietnam War, I did some actions around school, around the civil defense drills and the bomb tests, you know, which a lot of us, I mean, a lot of women were really very upset about, because that it had appeared suddenly that it was affecting the children and the milk,
Strontium 90,
you know, all of that. And I remember us going and talking to senators, and I remember them really being very cool with us and saying, "Ladies, go back and do your homework." Well, of course, we were right. So there was that, and then the village peace center was formed, and that began thinking in terms of both things, of the international and of the local. So that we were a lot of us that were part of that peace center were local activists or local people with local concerns, as well as international peace concerns. So that really, then the Vietnam War came, and my course was clear, so to speak. I mean, that really became a major interest to me, especially since I had a son who was growing up into the war.
How much did you want your political views and your political activism to enter into your stories?
Well, I can't say I ever felt I pushed them in. I mean, I think when I began to write about women in the beginning, those were really, that was not so much a political view as it was a political concern. That is to say, when you write, you really what you do is you illuminate what's hidden, and that's a political act. So, if I did, and I hope I did, illuminate the lives of the women I knew who were alone with kids and all that, that was a political act. So I illuminated them. They didn't happen to whatever their political positions were. That was another story. But that was from the beginning, I consider political, so to speak. Now, as for all the other interests of the women, in the way that it's a natural part of their lives, I certainly want it in there. I am interested, as I said, in certain events and in certain directions in the world, trends, and I am fearful for the world, and of course that has to get into it. You can't. It's not a question of want. It's there. You don't want, or you do want everything. There isn't anyone who writes a novel or a story that isn't political one way or another.
As you said, as a writer, you were always interested in women's lives. When the women's movement started to emerge in the 60s, did you identify with it immediately and become a part of it and consider yourself a feminist?
Well, I can't say I really considered myself a feminist till really the end of the 60s or early 70s. I mean, I didn't think about it, really, because I was totally wrapped up in the anti-Vietnam War. But I was always very interested in it. I was in a very early consciousness-raising group. And I became aware that I had been a feminist without really naming myself such. I think a lot of women were, you know, and writers too as well. So I feel that my own writing educated me in a funny sort of way.
It's ironic, I guess, that you never completed your academic training. You never actually got a BA, but now you've taught in many colleges. You're teaching now in two of them, at City College in New York and at Sarah Lawrence College. How do you feel about the academic life now that you're teaching in it as opposed to being a student in it?
I like it better as a teacher. But the truth is, I was really very young when they used to skip us more when we were in those days, and I was about 15 when I went to college and to Hunter. And Hunter and the college and at that time was really more of the same high school, a continuation of high school, and I meant to go to school. I remember feeling all the time that I really meant to go to get to school. I'd get to the first few steps. I'd start going up the steps, and something would prevent me always from entering the door of the classroom, and that's how much of my school career ended. Then I did try to go back to school, and I remember going to school at night at City College, and I liked that a lot and did well there. But then I got married, and then there was the war and the Second World War, and I lived in different places, and then I just life happened. That's all.
That was writer Grace Paley, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Grace Paley's latest collection of short stories is titled Later the Same Day. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Mark Moss and Ron Barron. Production assistants from Greg Allen and Amy Sallet. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.